For a year-end tax-deductible gift of $250 or more to Issues Etc., we'll send you our new book, Objections Overruled, Answering Arguments Against Christianity, and a recording of 15 Epiphany Hymns featuring the Lutheran Public Radio Choir. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org, or you could also contribute by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support. You've heard the argument. It goes a little something like this. The Bible was written so long ago, and by people who were, well, let's just be honest about it. They were primitive people who didn't have a modern conception of history. They weren't concerned about accuracy, and they were more into myths than facts and history. Or maybe this version of it, which is the Bible was written so long ago, and it might have been accurate to its day at one time, but it has been copied and recopied so many times by hand, and people have added things to it and taken things away from it. It is like a game of telephone. What may have been real back then has now just become a bunch of add-ons and mistakes and errors and elisions. So how do you respond to those arguments that all boil down to saying that the Bible isn't a reliable historical document? We're going to answer that argument for the remainder of Issues Etc. on this Thursday afternoon. It's part 8 of our series, Answering Arguments Against Christianity. Dr. Adam Francisco joins us. He's Assistant Provost for Mission and Identity at Concordia University, Chicago, author of a chapter in our new book, Objections Overruled. Dr. Francisco, welcome back.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Many assume that the Bible was written in a time and in a culture that had a very loose concept of history. How would you correct that assumption?
I would say that they certainly had a different conception of how one would record history than we do in maybe the 20th century. All bets are off in the 21st century, but they certainly were interested in accuracy in terms of detail and precision and, you know, obviously footnoting and things like that. That those aren't part of the culture of ancient historiography. But they are, whether it's biblical authors or, you know, some of the early Greek historians and certainly the Roman historians, they're interested in providing writing a narrative that corresponds to the events themselves.
How important was the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls in verifying the reliable transmission of the Old Testament?
I don't know what an expert on that in particular would say, but from just a general historical point of view, they're extremely important. Before the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls in the mid-20th century, the earliest Old Testament records or manuscripts that we had dated to about 1000 AD. So they're written, you know, over 1,500 years, or they're manuscripts that date to about 1,500 years after the last books of the Old Testament were written. So there's a long space. And the assumption a lot of people made in the 19th and early 20th century, higher critics, is that there's tons of space for legend and mythology to creep in. And it was also assumed that there must have, not only must things have been put into the text by later scribes, but there's no way on earth that text could have been preserved well over the centuries. Well, what the Dead Sea Scrolls tell us is it's a whole collection, a whole bunch of manuscripts, a lot of Old Testament or Hebrew scriptures, and they date anywhere from about, I think, 250 BC to about 25 or 50 AD. And when they compare the Dead Sea Scroll Old Testament documents to those medieval manuscripts, they find very little difference in the text itself. For example, in the book of Isaiah, there are just three minor differences in terms of the, if you will, the spelling of a word. In the book, Objections Overruled, I state that the differences are basically the equivalent to different spellings between American English and British English, where you might, in the word honor, you might have a U if you're spelling it as a British person. And that's about it. So it tells us that what the Jews have claimed this for centuries, that they've preserved the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible meticulously. And in fact, the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls demonstrates that.
How closely do the Old Testament contents correspond to known history of the ancient Near East?
Well, that's a big and important question. There is no contradiction between the Old Testament and, let's say, a secular historiography of the ancient Near East. There are, to be sure, difficulties. Archaeology, as it corresponds to the Old Testament, you know, there's a lot of big issues. For example, the exodus of the Israelites out of Egypt, that where scholars have debated for decades, maybe more than a century now, and will probably continue to debate, you know, over issues concerning the date, you know, when the exodus took place. It used to be scholars about 100 years ago were, I don't know if amazed is the right word, but were kind of interested in the fact that there was no real record of Hebrews living in Egypt, at least according to the national history of ancient Egypt. And so some went a step further and said, oh, that must mean the whole story of the Exodus is made up by Moses. And then all of a sudden, archaeologists go back to work and they find little traces of evidence of Hebrews living in Egypt. And then, you know, as more and more evidence is discovered, the debate has shifted, it seems, from did the Exodus actually happen to when did it happen? Was it 13th century BC or 15th century BC or somewhere in between? So Old Testament archaeology kind of works like that, where something's discovered and there's a whole host, we're talking decades-long debate over how to interpret the evidence in light of known chronology, secular, if we could call it that, historiography, and so on. So not too long ago, I think this is the mid-1990s, after about four decades of people, archaeologists, assuming that the city of Jericho didn't really exist, or at least there was no evidence left of it, as it would advance by a fairly famous archaeologist in the mid-20th century, Kathleen Kenyon. Mid-1990s, another scholar or another archaeologist was digging after he retired from his job at the University of Toronto and found the ruins of the city of Jericho and found fascinating details corresponding to Jericho that confirms the Old Testament story about the walls falling down. They even found pottery in the ruins of Jericho that still had grain in it, which some say is further evidence of the truthfulness of the Old Testament narrative, because if we read it closely, God instructs the Israelites, when the walls fall down, do not take a thing from Jericho. So normally if a city was ransacked and destroyed, you know, the looters would take whatever they could get their hands on and run off with the treasure. That didn't happen at Jericho.
Given the fact that archaeology is relatively such a new discipline and is really only kind of now getting its feet underneath it and digging in literally and figuratively, do you expect further kind of groundbreaking discoveries like that that corroborate what the Bible tells us in the Old Testament?
I'm not sure. I mean, I guess I expected. I certainly would not be surprised. I mean, it's amazing the things that pop up. Now, I should say as a side note that if you follow like PBS or Discovery Channel or the History Channel, there will always be these documentaries about recent finds that call into question the authenticity of the biblical record. And then you just, if you're patient, you'll see a year or two, a couple of years later, that sensationalist find is proven to be a fraud, or new evidence discounts the authenticity of that fact, and so on. But I think Paul Meyer, who I'm sure has been on your show for years, has said, very recently said, that people living today have access to more evidence of the biblical narrative than any other generation except for the generations living during those particular time periods. You know, access to evidence in terms of just what archaeology has made available, but also you no longer have to go to a library and put on special gloves to open up a book, you know, an ancient manuscript and read the text. Now you can just go on Google and find a picture of it and do it for yourself. So going forward, I mean, it's amazing. I don't remember the year anymore, but it's been within maybe three decades that they found the empty bone box of Joseph Caiaphas. I remember being very young and hearing about how historians, and I'd put air quotes around that, said that there's no reason to believe Pontius Pilate existed. It's something that the New Testament author, a figure the New Testament authors made up. And then it was, boy, I think late 1970s, an inscription with Pontius Pilate's name was found in the northern parts of the Holy Land, proving that he was, in fact, a real historical person, a prefect of Judea. So those sorts of discoveries, I think, are going to be probably increasing. But at the same time, it wouldn't surprise me if not a whole lot more is found, because those events happened in the New Testament 2,000 years ago, the Old Testament even longer. And with time, of course, things like wood and paper or leather or papyrus, you know, that eventually deteriorates. So it's hard to know. I don't think I would caution grounding one's faith in archaeological evidence, but archaeological finds sure are fantastic when they confirm what we already know to be true.
Turning to the New Testament, it is more open to historical investigation. Do Christians need to fear this fact?
I don't think so. I mean, Paul, as Luke records it in Acts 26, when he's standing before King Agrippa, he says, he makes this, I think it's an incredible way of putting it, he says that King Agrippa knows that these things I'm speaking about, namely the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus, did not happen in a corner. So if the New Testament is a record of what happened and what the apostles were teaching, like what they really taught in real time, in real space, we should have no fear of what facts we might find. Nobody should be afraid of any facts. Where the issue come or arises in terms of accusations of inaccuracy and so on is not the facts themselves, but the interpretation of the facts. I find that working in the field of apologetics for now two decades, I've kind of known it all along. I didn't want to believe it, I guess, but more I'm realizing that the claims of skeptics, while we should take them seriously and answer them seriously, oftentimes they're not as grounded in facts or reason as they appear, maybe rhetorically. Oftentimes always when people reject the New Testament account of the life and teachings of Jesus or the reliability of the New Testament in general, it's not because they found some new evidence that throws it all into question or anything like that, but rather they object to what the content of the text and what it teaches.
Dr. Adam Francisco is our guest. He is Assistant Provost for Mission and Identity at Concordia University, Chicago, and author of a chapter in our book, Objections Overruled. We're answering the objection, the Bible isn't a reliable historical document. We'll talk about eyewitnesses next. Thanks to our listeners, Issues Etc. has operated independently and in the black for 12 consecutive years. With 2 weeks left in 2020, we're $95,000 short of expenses. Please make a year-end tax-deductible gift to support this worldwide outreach. You can make a secure online contribution at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234.
Is your school or homeschool ready to take the next step in teaching students with learning challenges? We can help. The Simply Classical curriculum, voted number one for special learners, is available from Memoria Press for students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome. We provide everything you need for a full year. Use promo code LPR21 at simplyclassical.com. simplyclassical.com.
Daily exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc. Hi, this is Rahema Kavuga, Synod Relations Manager of Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Are you an investor looking to support the bold and loving work of LCMS churches? Is your church or organization ready to do bold and loving work? This year, we have a ripe opportunity to bring Christ to a hurting world. Discover the role you can play in this great work. Call 800-843-5233 or visit lcef.org. That's 800-843-5233, lcef.org.
The rest of the world around us does not live with hope. For them, safety is the highest good. I would argue for Christians, it should not be that way. For us, safety cannot be the most important thing. For us, the most important thing is receiving God's gifts, walking with Christ, serving those around us.
I think really that the only two logical and reasonable options are to say, Jesus claimed to be God, and either he understood himself to be God, or he was lying about being God. Those are really our only two options, I think.
LGBT itself is inherently binary, but it is an effort to try to do away with the binary, and that's why the thing is cannibalizing itself.
Our God is the God of history who created the world, who set time into motion, and the time of Christ's birth was the perfect time in history.
Well, you don't have to listen live to Play Issues, Etc. soundbite of the week on Friday afternoon, December the 18th. We've posted this week's candidates in advance on our podcast feed and on the Talk on Demand archives page at issuesetc.org. The listener with the best vote wins the LPR bundle package. That's a Holy Family outdoor nativity set from the Outdoor Nativity Store, an Ad Crucem baptismal keepsake, the I Have Issues t-shirt, and an Issues Etc. pen, bumper sticker, notepad, and tote bag. Issues Etc. soundbite of the week. It's part 8 of our series, Answering Arguments Against Christianity. The argument today, the Bible isn't a reliable historical document. Dr. Adam Francisco of Concordia University, Chicago, is our guest. Dr. Francisco, how should we evaluate the claims by some of the authors to have been eyewitnesses of the events they record?
Well, I mean, according to sort of normal rules for looking at ancient documents, we take authors at their word unless there's reason to doubt them. So there's a couple places, I think, depending on how you break it down, at least four places in the Gospel of John, the prologue to the Gospel of Luke, 2 Peter, and 1 John, where the authors claim to be eyewitnesses or base their writing on eyewitness testimony in the case of Luke. Early church testimony passed through John's disciple to a man named Irenaeus in the mid to later 2nd century. He tells us that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that Matthew and John were eyewitnesses, and Mark was a companion of the Apostle Peter, and Luke was a companion of the Apostle Paul. So I'm thinking as a historian, I'm going to take the word of people who live close to the events over the word of, say, a 21st century higher critic masquerading as a text critic, like a person like Bart Ehrman.
Why is it important that the New Testament was written, at least in historical terms, very, very close, almost on top of the events that are described?
It's important for probably a lot of reasons, but for one that just sort of sticks out in my mind is it's quite unusual. You know, you do have some ancient historians like Herodotus, who wrote the history of the Greek and Persian Wars, kind of memorialized in those movies, 300, Part 1 and Part 2. He's writing maybe 5 decades from the events, so fairly close by ancient standards. But by and large, most ancient historiographers, that is, those people whose profession it was to describe the past in a way that corresponded to the evidence of the past or what actually happened in the past. Most of those ancient historians are living centuries later, in many ways not too dissimilar to the task of historians today who write on, for example, the Middle Ages or even the Reformation. We're 500 years past those events. Difference for us is that our evidence, just a lot more evidence and a lot more traditions of scholarship of that to interact with. But the New Testament authors, the Gospels in particular, they all wrote within the first century. There's a lot of debate about when Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John wrote. and a lot of different arguments for the, you know, the chronology and who wrote first and so on. And we may never know exactly who wrote first and when they wrote, but it does seem that they wrote fairly quickly after Jesus' ascension into heaven. And by quickly, I mean maybe 2 decades, give or take a few. And that's important because that means, at least for Matthew and John, who are eyewitnesses, they were actually there. So when they're writing, you can, by historian standards, trust that they're giving you, you know, an account of what they saw or what they heard from other companions or eyewitnesses of the life and teachings of Jesus. So, and again, that's quite unusual for the ancient world.
Let's talk about the manuscript evidence for the New Testament. First of all, what do we mean by that term, manuscript evidence, and how does it stack up?
Some of your listeners may recall the books by Josh McDowell from, boy, was that 50 years ago now? Evidence That Demands a Verdict. And there's, in the first volume, there's just page after page of listing of these New Testament manuscripts and comparing them to the amount we have and the quality of the amount that we have from other Roman and Greek texts. By New Testament manuscripts, we mean those handwritten copies. So let's just think about the Gospels. So you have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The original source, the original piece that they wrote, we typically call the autographs, the things they wrote. We don't have those, or at least there's no reason to think we have those. Do they still exist? They might be buried somewhere or put, you know, in a jar in a cave somewhere, but it'd be really surprising if they did exist because, again, the further you go back, the more that the elements play with papyrus and paper and leather or other things people wrote on, the more it wears it away. But after those original autographs, then you start to get people who copy that original autograph. And all those copies and copies of those copies we call manuscripts if they're handwritten. And with, you know, the printing press isn't invented until about the mid-15th century. So you have about 1,400 years between when Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John wrote and you actually have a printing press. So in that time space, you have of Greek manuscripts and fragments, we could include so little pieces of the New Testament, you have upwards of, you know, 5,700 manuscripts and fragments. Some will put the number as high as 6,000, depending on what counts as a New Testament manuscript. Do lectionaries count, or is it just a text that purports to be part of the New Testament? So close to 6,000 of those. If you take into account the translations from Greek into languages like Coptic in ancient Egypt, or Latin in Rome, or Armenian up in the northeastern parts of the ancient Mediterranean world, and other translations, that number of manuscripts, handwritten copies of copies, approaches at least 25,000, close to 30,000, some would say. So that's a whole lot of manuscripts, especially in comparison to any other literary tradition from the ancient world. The only thing that comes close is Homer's Iliad. And, you know, that was written probably about 700, maybe 800 years before the Gospels were written. So there's a lot more time to accumulate manuscripts. But even so, we have about 700 to 800 manuscripts of Homer's Iliad, manuscripts and fragments. So, and that's the only thing that comes close. If you look at late 1st or 2nd century Greco-Roman writings, you know, some of the more popular historians, I usually use the examples of Suetonius. He's writing early 2nd century, Tacitus, early 2nd century, and Josephus. He's late 1st and maybe into the early 2nd. These are historians, Josephus being a Jew, Suetonius and Tacitus being Roman historians. And they're still, when I used to teach courses on Western civilization, on the Roman Empire, when we're looking at the emperors of the Roman Empire, we would use primary texts, and Suetonius or Tacitus were our primary sources. Why? Because nobody really doubts that what we have today in translation isn't an accurate rendition of what Suetonius originally wrote. The interesting thing is, though, that in terms of the number of manuscripts of those two Roman, that one Jewish author that we have, it's maybe a couple hundred, 200, give or take. And the time between which those authors wrote and the earliest manuscripts that we have is anywhere from 800 to 900 years. So we don't have anything for at least 800 years from when Suetonius or Tacitus wrote to the actual manuscript evidence that we have of Suetonius and Tacitus. And nobody really doubts that that's been well preserved, and it gives us at least a picture of the events or the emperors or descriptions of the emperors as Suetonius or Tacitus understood them to be. Compare that to the New Testament. And I should say Suetonius, Tacitus, and Josephus, those are the best preserved manuscripts and manuscript traditions that we have from about the time period in which the New Testament writers are writing. Compare that to the New Testament record, just in Greek, it's thousands and thousands more manuscripts and fragments. So scholars who make their living, so to speak, and looking at the New Testament and trying to discern, since we don't have the original autographs, what the original autographs looked like in terms of how things were spelled and what the word order was and so on, they've just got a treasure trove of evidence. I think one scholar has even said there's an embarrassing amount of evidence. Some have gone so far as to say, and this is not uncommon actually, that while we don't have the original autographs, because we have so much evidence in the manuscripts, the original autograph, we can know with about a 99% degree of certainty what the original autograph looked like. So in short, with the New Testament manuscripts, it's incredible what we have.
We're responding to the argument the Bible isn't a reliable historical document with Dr. Adam Francisco, author of a chapter in our new book, Objections Overruled. Here are the other contributors to Objections Overruled, Answering Arguments Against Christianity. Paul Meyer, John Warwick Montgomery, Alvin Schmidt, Corey Moss, John Bombaro, Angus Manoos, Craig Parton, Kirk Clayton, and Mark Pearson. We'll send you Objections Overruled and a new recording of 15 Epiphany hymns featuring the Lutheran Public Radio Choir for a year-end tax-deductible donation of $250 or more. You can make a financial gift by giving us a call, 618-223-8385, or online at issuesetc.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. at the end of 2020. We'll talk about how faithfully these texts were transmitted next. Listen to the best of the church's music for the Advent season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Advent season, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Where was Jesus before the New Testament? What was he doing before his incarnation? Was he just like a pitcher that pitches the first perfect pitch and then was pulled until the end of the game? Of course not. He was active all throughout the scriptures, and this is the question that Dr. Charles Geeshan asks in his article in the December issue of the Lutheran Witness, The Presence of the Son Before Christ. To learn more, visit cph.org/witness to subscribe. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
It's almost that special time to unpack your Advent and Christmas ornaments. But there's a problem. Your ornaments are from the 80s. They're made of styrofoam, the glitter has dropped off, and they are being held together with toothpicks. Don't celebrate another Christmas harkening back to the age of glitter balls. Ad Crucem's ornaments are beautifully designed and lovingly made, right here in Colorado. We offer all the old designs and a whole lot of new ones. Visit adcrucem.com. That's ADCRUCEM.com.
Deaconesses are women trained to share the gospel of Jesus Christ through works of mercy, spiritual care, and teaching of the Christian faith. The word deaconess means servant. Find out more on how you can serve in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod through the vocation of deaconess at lcms.org/deaconess. Working in faith, laboring in love, remaining steadfast in the hope of our Lord Jesus Christ. LCMS Deaconess Ministry, lcms.org/deaconess.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. on this Thursday, December the 17th. It's part 8 of our series, Answering Arguments Against Christianity. The argument today, the Bible isn't a reliable historical document. Dr. Adam Francisco of Concordia University, Chicago is our guest. So we were talking about the manuscripts themselves before the break. What picture emerges of how faithfully these texts were transmitted over time?
Well, this is probably one of the most important questions, especially in the realm of apologetics for Christians today, because it's not uncommon, again, on things like the History Channel or, you know, Discovery Channel, especially on Christmas and Easter morning, if you're you go to early service and you sit down and watch a documentary that looks at the origins of Christmas or the origins of Easter or something, there'll be a well-produced documentary, and it will parade before you a predictable cast of scholars, Elaine Pagels, for example, or Bart Ehrman especially. They'll be interviewed and they will make claims to the fact that they will say that while the New Testament, for example, with Bart Ehrman, he'll say Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John might be our best sources for understanding the life and teachings of Jesus because they are the earliest sources. However, he'll add in after that, the problem is that the text itself has not been transmitted reliably. And what he'll go on to say is, and he kind of became real famous in a book entitled Misquoting Jesus, where he says that something to the effect of there are more variants among the thousands of New Testament or gospel manuscripts that we have than there are words of the New Testament. And that's not wholly untrue. The problem is that it lacks any sort of context. There are lots and lots and lots of variants or what we might call copious errors in these manuscripts. Words get misspelled. Sometimes John's name is spelled with one N or new or two. Sometimes if you count lectionaries as manuscripts, if a reading from the New Testament passage in the New Testament starts with a pronoun, the scribe transcribing in the lectionary will replace that pronoun with the proper noun that it corresponds to provide context for the reading. So if you look at those things, there's about 90, somewhere between 97 and 99% of the variants can be accounted for in that way. So they're real easy, completely expected in any sort of study of any sort of manuscript that you're going to have these copious errors. There are some issues in the Gospels, for example, are two big issues. Your listeners might be familiar, for example, that the ending of the Gospel of Mark, starting at verse 9, there's a couple different endings. One just puts it at an end right there at verse 9. There's others that will go to, I think it's verse 16 or 17, and usually you'll find a footnote if you have a good study Bible that will tell you that the earliest manuscripts don't contain that particular ending. And what all that's saying is that in the manuscript record, the later manuscripts might have that ending, but the earliest one we have doesn't. And what that doesn't mean is that somebody arbitrarily added that in. It might mean that, but it doesn't necessarily mean that. It might just mean that the original autograph had that ending, but the earliest manuscript that copied that just didn't for some reason. Maybe they ran out of space or what have you. And then maybe it was later added in later on by the next copyist, and that copy went missing. It's really hard to know why these things happened. But even if you took a very skeptical line and say, well, let's just remove it, the ending of the Gospel of Mark, it would cause some issues in terms of proof texting. The Small Catechism, for example, will quote the ending of Mark chapter 16, where Jesus says, he who is believed and is baptized shall be saved. But that's taught elsewhere in the New Testament. So it's not, for me at least, it's not as big of an issue. I don't have any problem accepting the ending of the Gospel of Mark, but it doesn't affect the general reliability of what's being transmitted in terms of the narrative, you know, the events themselves or the actual the doctrine that's being taught. There's one other place in the Gospel of John. It's the fairly famous story of the woman caught in adultery, starting at John chapter 7, verse 53, goes to chapter 8, verse 10 or 11, and that's not found in early manuscripts either. Again, why is it there? We really don't know. But those are the two big issues. Everything else can be easily accounted for just by recognizing the fact that there was no word processor that told you when you misspelled a word, or maybe your word, you know, there was no Grammarly in the ancient world or the medieval world telling you that your grammar or your word order might be messed up. It's all very predictable. And Christians have never really said that when we confess that the scriptures are inspired and inerrant, what we're not saying is that God has perfectly preserved the transmission of these manuscripts over the centuries, that he's guided the hand of every scribe in the dark monasteries of the Middle Ages. We've never said that. Muslims say that about their Quran, but Christians don't say that about the biblical texts. We confess that it's inerrant in that the original autographs, because they are God's word, they can't err. That doesn't mean later scribes couldn't have, without proper lighting, without proper sleep, and maybe even nutrition, certainly they would have made mistakes. But that doesn't, from a historian's perspective, doesn't affect their reliability one bit.
So do other ancient historical sources in and around the New Testament, do they match the New Testament accounts insofar as they overlap?
There's not like a tremendous amount of overlap, but there is nothing in Roman or Jewish writings that contradicts the historical narrative found in the New Testament. Suetonius, Tacitus, and Josephus give us quite a bit of information on Jesus' life, especially his crucifixion, and as Josephus put it in his work, that people even claim that he rose from the dead. So nothing really contradicts it. It's interesting, in the Gospel of Matthew, there is one place, but it's found in the Gospel of Matthew, that says there was a claim circulated that actually was invented when the tomb was found empty on Easter morning, recognizing that this would be a issue for the religious status quo in Jerusalem. The guards were paid off to circulate the story that the disciples stole Jesus' body. But that's the Gospel of Matthew telling us about the one story, the one piece of evidence, if you will, that contradicts the apostolic narrative. And that's the only contradiction you find, which is really quite amazing. I've seen it elsewhere. I'm not the first one to say it, but I oftentimes say that Romans and Jews in and around the Holy Land had a huge problem with Christianity. It was, people claimed in, I believe it was in Thessalonica in Acts chapter 17, they complained about how Paul and others like him were turning the world upside down. So there's the Jews and the Romans had every means, motive, and opportunity to show that the preaching of the apostles and their eventual writing down of what they preached was false, and not a single person provides any evidence to the contrary.
For almost two centuries now, Adam, biblical scholarship, a certain branch of it, has worked pretty hard to cast doubt on the Bible's reliability. How has this kind of scholarship approached the Bible?
Well, there's a whole history here, and it gets quite complicated. This is going to be painting with a broad brush, but I think it's fair to say that scholarship, sometimes described generally as higher criticism, that emerges in, or at least is under the influence of the Enlightenment, if not originating in the Enlightenment, assumes certain things are true and uniform. In particular, miracles don't happen. If it's a scholar of the Bible and he carries those assumptions and maybe is purporting to act like a historian or to do the work of a historian, if they assume that miracles don't happen and yet they're a historian of early Christianity, let's say, and they have this evidence before them, the best evidence that they have for the early church, and that evidence includes in it these remarkable stories of Jesus rising from the dead or healing a paralytic or restoring sight to the blind and so on. Their assumption that miracles don't happen is going to not just inform, but I would say determine what conclusions they draw about Jesus, the nature of the evidence that they're looking at, and the teachings of the church. So if miracles didn't happen, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to draw the conclusion, if miracles don't happen, that the stories that the tomb was empty on Sunday, Easter morning has to be explained a different way. Maybe the disciples did steal a body, or perhaps the disciples went to the wrong tomb, or any other popular theory that's out there. But all those different theories, those from Bible scholars, those claims or conclusions are based on assumptions. So I can't remember exactly where I wrote this. I got a little flack for it, but in talking about higher criticism and how it assumes, let's just say, a worldview, it assumes a very naturalistic worldview, and then it interprets the evidence in light of that worldview and comes up with all these theories about the empty tomb, for example, I suggest that that looks much more like conspiracy theorizing than it does look like historiography. Thinking about the empty tomb, there have been some, and nobody, I don't think people take them seriously, but there have been some, and I'm using air quotes here in the studio, there have been some scholars who have suggested that maybe the tomb being empty on Easter morning and people believing that Jesus rose from the dead can be accounted for by positing that maybe some extraterrestrials took his body up into outer space. And those sorts of things, they're not taken seriously by a lot of people, but they do count as, in some quarters, as scholarly approaches to the life and teachings of Jesus, which is just remarkable. Having been in the academic world for some time now, none of this is really all that surprising. One thing that as I get older, I'm trying more and more to learn is that nothing should surprise you about what people say about, especially Christianity, and in particular about Jesus, because for the modern mind, his teachings are so offensive that people will find any way or put forward any sort of theory to get around him.
Finally, can the average student of Scripture trust this book and its historical reliability?
Well, absolutely. And if I can just say it in a word, but I might add more to it. I mean, you couldn't do it now with COVID, and sometimes in years past, it wasn't as, there was always an element of danger depending on what was going on in and around the Holy Land. But you could quite literally take the New Testament and get on a plane and go to Jerusalem and the areas around Jerusalem and trace. You're not going to know with absolute certainty all the particular locations, but you could walk where Jesus walked. You could see many of the sites that Jesus would have seen. You can see, for example, the pool at Bethesda. You could see with not certainty, but a pretty good, a reasonable conjecture. You could if I can draw back from that a bit. You could go to, for example, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and while it may not be exactly the site where Jesus rose from the dead, there's pretty good historical reasons to believe that, in fact, that church was built on top of Jesus' tomb. You could go into the museum there and see all sorts of other artifacts that correspond to both the New Testament and the Old Testament narrative. So, for the average student of Scripture, if you've got the wherewithal and the money, you could take your Bible and be confident that it provides a map to the world that it purports to describe. That's not to say that the Bible is a world history or is an elaborate scientific textbook. It certainly has a lot of history in it, and it certainly has a lot of scientific facts, geographical facts, but it's looking at a very particular world in the much larger world. So, hypothetically speaking, you could, if you're doing a course on ancient history or the ancient Mediterranean, for example, along with your Roman and your Greek and maybe your Jewish and North African authors, you could certainly include the New Testament, for example, as a primary and reliable source to use to understand the ancient Mediterranean.
Dr. Adam Francisco is Assistant Provost for Mission and Identity At Concordia University Chicago, he's author of a chapter in our new book, Objections Overruled. Dr. Francisco, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Friday on Issues Etc., we'll discuss apparent contradictions in the Bible on Jesus' birth. Dr. Peter Scare of Concordia Theological Seminary will be our guest. We'll talk with Pastor Chris Roseborough of Fighting for the Faith about the sad irony of celebrity pastors, and we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. Listen and vote in advance at facebook.com/issuesetc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
In a world awash with all sorts of information, opinions, and ideas, there is still a place where God's Word is the central and only focus. Messiah Lutheran Church, 801 North Madison, Lebanon, Illinois. At 9 o'clock on Sunday mornings, God's people gather there to listen to Him. There you will find His words of law and gospel, and of course, our Lord's Holy Supper. Bible classes focus on the Bible and the Lutheran confessions. Come, listen, believe, and live, and check out our website at messiahlebanon.org.